If you want to learn something new, would you rather learn it on your own, from a random teacher, or from folks who are the best of the best in that skill? I think I know which option most of you would choose. That's made possible by MasterClass. In recent months, they've added classes from the likes of Ava DuVernay, who gives us tips on how to reframe our thinking in all walks of life. One of our personal favorites recently was the one-on-one time we got with Amy Poehler in her class on preparing to be unprepared. So good. With Ava DuVernay. With over 180 world-class instructors and a 30-day money-back guarantee for new members, there's no reason not to get started today. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/hardthings. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/hardthings. masterclass.com/hardthings.
Spring cleaning isn't just for your garage and basement. How about that sock drawer? With new drops of incredibly soft socks to go along with tees and underwear, Bombas is the brand you need for a spring refresh. The only thing I like more than the comfiness of Bombas is their amazing mission. One item purchased equals one donated. Get comfy this spring and give back with Bombas. Head over to bombas.com/hardthings and use code HARDTHINGS for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/hardthings and use code HARDTHINGS at checkout.
I walked through fire, I came out the other side.
Okay, welcome to We Can Do Hard Things. We have a big treat for you today. Jeanette McCurdy is the New York Times bestselling author of I'm Glad My Mom Died, which stayed at number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 8 consecutive weeks and has remained on the list for 24. In her memoir, Jeanette dives into her struggles as a former child actor, including eating disorders, addiction, and a complicated relationship with her overbearing mother, and how she retook control of her life. Jeanette has been honored as part of the 2022 Time 100 Next list, and her debut fiction novel will be released in 2024, which I find very exciting.
Yes.
Jeanette, I read your book when it came out.
Oh, thank you.
Loved it. I was thinking this morning about why I was so excited about it. And first of all, I feel like sometimes people have a great story. And so no matter what they write, it's going to be good. People are going to like it. And sometimes people are just great writers. And so no matter what they write, it's going to be good. And then every once in a while, there's somebody who has a great story and who is a great writer. Your book, fantastic fucking story. But also your writing is so fresh and so exciting and so different. We have been so excited for this conversation. We all adore you. How are you today?
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for the kind words coming from you. I almost can't even believe it. You know, when somebody that you really respect and look up to so much says something, and it's just like, I feel dizzy right now. I truly feel so excited. I just think you're just the best. And the way that you write and make your work accessible so that it can be healing to others. It's helped me heal so much. It's so rare, I think, to be able to make something entertaining and meaningful at the same time. And you do that. And so just the kind words from you is like is just beyond. And thank you.
Well, you do that. You are in this part of your life, it seems to me, that you started with acting and performing other people's lives and words. And now you are changing your perspective and using your own words and telling your own stories. What is a story that you could tell us that you feel like encapsulates the relationship with your mom and the dynamic in your family?
I feel like it would be just kind of starting with what the separate pillars of my life were, which were all kind of unique, a bubble in each of their own senses. So like I grew up Mormon, I was LDS. There was that bubble. I grew up homeschooled, because my mom wanted to homeschool my brothers and I. So there was that bubble. My mom was a hoarder. So we lived in a 1200 square foot house with 8 people and floor to ceiling, knickknacks and trash. Our fridge was overflowing, always smelling. It was just a nasty smell the second you walk in the house, and usually like 4 different nasty smells hitting you from different sides of the house. And I was also a child actor. My mom had wanted to be an actress her whole life, and she wasn't able to. Her parents didn't want her to act. So from a very early age, she told me, hey, Annette, I want you to be mommy's little actress. And I did that just knowing my mom's very erratic behavior and volatile behavior. And I didn't know this at the time, of course, but I was just in an environment of a lot of chaos and dysfunction. And I felt like it was my responsibility to hold down the fort and keep mom happy because I had three older brothers. And I felt like as great as they were, they didn't pick up on mom's cues the same way that mm-hmm. I did. They didn't know, you know, when mom stepped in water with her tights that she was going to have a complete meltdown and that it was just going to be chaos for the rest of the day. I felt like anytime she had one of her fits, for lack of a better term, everyone was confused. Like, how did this happen? Where did this come from? She was fine 3 seconds ago. Why is she now screaming at everybody? And I think, well, I know exactly what happened. Grandpa came home late and then dad came home late. And because both of them came home late, she was already triggered and already in her thing. And then because the dishes weren't done, she had a meltdown. Like mm-hmm. it just felt very simple in my kid logic. Mm-hmm. So all of that led me to be very anxious and hypersensitive. The anxiety wasn't great. And the hypersensitivity didn't feel great for a while, but now I think it's really useful and I'm really grateful for it. And I feel like it's a really helpful tool and I'm glad that I have it.
Hmm. All that's going on with your mom. And then it feels like this bond that she tried to create with you was based on you not individuating, you not growing away from her. So I think a lot of people can probably relate to that with their moms on all different levels. With you, it became literal when you started noticing that you were developing breasts and growing. Tell us what happened.
I felt like a puffiness in one of my nipples. I thought that that was cancer because my mom had cancer. Oh, that was another one of the pillars. Yes. My mom had stage 4 cancer when I was 2. And so the family was always sort of revolving around keeping mom well and keeping mom happy mm-hmm. because we didn't want her to die. And it was really scary. And she was on the brink of that for a while when I was really little.
Didn't she play a movie that you all watched every single Sunday of her when she was going through the early stages? It was like an intentional reminder that she wanted that to be the center of your world is
exactly
her illness. Right.
You nailed it. Yeah. It was this video where she was singing all of us songs and she would replay it every Sunday after church. She'd pop it. She'd have somebody else pop it in the VCR because she could never figure out how to work the VCR. I inherited that from her. I'm terrible at technology. Yeah. Like, thank God for Lauren. She helped me to figure out how to work the volume on my computer. But my mom just really was, as I see it, kind of fixated on cancer and the identity that it gave her. And it's really sad to me now that I think she didn't have much of an identity outside of that. So that was kind of it. Mm-hmm. And then her identity being entrenched in cancer then became, well, I'm going to entrench my identity in my daughter. So when I was 11, I felt just like a breast developing. I felt a little mm-hmm. bit of puffiness in my nipple, but I thought that it was cancer. I thought, oh, mom had cancer. Now I have cancer. So I thought, should I tell mom? Should I not tell mom? I don't want to stress her out. Eventually I told her and she said, oh no, that's boobies coming in, Net. And I said, well, is there anything I can do to stop the boobs from coming in? Knowing, well, I'm a child actor. It helps to look younger for your age. You book a lot more roles if you look younger. Mm-hmm. And I said, is there anything I do to stop the boobies from coming in? And she said, well, yeah, there's this thing called calorie restriction. And she taught me calorie restriction. She calorie restricted herself. A lot of her eating patterns started making a lot of sense to me. Because mm-hmm. I would always think, well, she only eats like half of a chewy granola bar before 5 p.m. And then she eats a plate of steamed vegetables with no salt, butter, nothing, just steamed vegetables. That was her diet every single day. And I had noticed before that it really wasn't the same as anybody else. But as soon as she taught me calorie restriction, I realized, oh, that's what mom's doing too. So mm-hmm. it felt like a great opportunity for bonding. I wanted to be close to mom. I wanted to be as close to my mom as I could possibly be. And suddenly we have this secret, this thing that she explicitly told me to not tell anyone else about, that it was our little bond. Mm-hmm. And it felt really exciting to me. And it felt really special to me. And it felt like, wow, mom and I have a secret nobody else knows about. She's not calorie restricting with the boys. They get to eat whatever they want. They get their hamburger helper and a whole heap and spoonful. And I get to be over here with my celery sticks and my 12 mini wheats. And that's going to do it for me. I loved it at first. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, eventually did not.
And she enforced it too, didn't she? She measured your thighs and weighed you regularly.
Measured my thighs.
It was an enforced thing.
Yep. She measured my thighs. She weighed me. She portioned out my meals. We would calorie count together at the end of every night. She had me on a 1,200 calorie diet and then it was a 1,000 calorie diet. And I was a growing child. that's not how it should go. And I would also thought, well, okay, if I'm on a 1,000-calorie diet, I'll just eat half my food because then I'll be doing less calories, which will be even better. And she'd be like, yay. She'd be so excited. She'd look at you like, oh, good girl, good girl. It lit her up. The anorexia that I had lit her up. And I did not know it was anorexia until I heard a doctor confronting my mom about my weight through the doctor's office door. And I didn't know what anorexia was. I heard the word and I thought, huh, that's a funny word. And I just kind of shoved it down and shoved down any concern because my mom very quickly, she was very, very convincing, really charming, really quite captivating. And, you know, I hear her telling the doctor like, oh, okay, I'll keep an eye out on Annette's eating behaviors. I'll make sure, she's eating normally. She's eating normally. I see her every day. And I'm hearing this thinking, she's monitoring every single thing I eat. It shouldn't be news to her. Like, I know I'm losing weight. She weighs me. I know I'm smaller. She's measuring me. But I was only 11. I couldn't accept the reality that my mom would be doing something like that. There's no way of processing that at that age. So I just kept thinking, okay, well, I just got to trust mom knows best. Mom does what's best. Mom loves me. And I kept clinging to that denial for a long time, a really long time.
When did the denial stop?
After she died. It was literally after she died. I would say I first started getting the inklings of it. You mentioned something about the individuating. And something that was really interesting to me and really uncomfortable for me was that I grew up thinking, well, my mom wants me to be successful. My mom wants me to be famous. That's her dream. And then when I finally got an opportunity to be a series regular on a show, I thought, great, mom's dream has come true. She's going to be happy now. And she wasn't happy, just kind of seemed like it was never enough at that point. But once fame hit and people started approaching me in the streets and it started getting pretty intense, then she seemed angry at me and jealous of me. And I thought about this a lot in adulthood and how I think it's that fame was the thing that made her realize we're not the same person. Because up until then, it could be we booked it and it could be us hand in hand and us on the sets and her mouthing the words off to the side and looking at me and giving me direction. It felt like we were the same person. And then I think they're wanting my picture and not hers. It seemed to make her really angry and really vicious. She'd scream, I have fans too. I'm going to make a Vine account and people are going to love my videos. I kind of wish she had made a Vine account. I think it would have been so funny. She never did, but it was a frequent threat. But I think that was the thing that made her realize, oh, we're not the same.
And when you're talking about kind of the unveiling, your first therapist when you were 21 told you that what was happening to you was abuse and you left that therapist. That was too early to absorb that information.
Yep.
Have you heard, Jeanette, of the betrayal blindness theory?
No.
Okay. So I came across this when I was thinking about you, and I find it fascinating. This woman, Dr. Jennifer Frade, she discovered and named this phenomenon of betrayal blindness and this idea that you do not allow yourself to see the reality of what is going on. Because if you did, the information would threaten the relationship on which you most depend. So it's really logical when you think about it. I mean, some ways you can berate yourself, like, how did I not accept that? But if the person who betrays you is someone on whom you depend, then you essentially need to ignore the betrayal because responding to it further threatens your attachment. And if you're dependent on them, therefore
you're right,
mental, physical, and emotional life. I mean, it makes sense to do that. And so it's either not knowing or unawareness or actually forgetting. Like actually not having it stay in your memory. It's just so fascinating because what's beautiful about that is that in her research, she found that you come out of betrayal blindness when you're able to handle the information, when you have built the internal resources to be able to look at it squarely and survive it.
Of course. That's why I just started recovery from anorexia.
Yeah.
I needed to get myself to a place where it was safe enough to let go of the thing that I needed, which is what we all do. We don't stop doing the thing, whether it's loyalty to booze or food or a toxic parent, until we know we're strong enough to handle whatever information's going to come up.
But that's why I think the title of your book seems scandalous that I'm glad my mom died. But when you think about what would I have had to believe, what would I have had to feel, to lose, to accept if I looked at the way she treated me growing up, you would have had to lose so much. So when your mom dies and you can actually look at it and realize you can survive, of course you're grateful because you can survive.
Wow.
Quick math, the less your business spends on operations and multiple systems, the more margin you have and the more of your hard-earned money you get to keep. But with higher expenses than ever on things like materials and distribution, everything just costs more. That's why smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. You'll reduce IT costs, you'll cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and you'll improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, and expenses don't slow down, so why should you?
By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/hardthings. netsuite.com/hardthings. That's netsuite.com/hardthings.
Glennon, I wanted to ask about your recovery. I'm aware of everything and I just wasn't sure. How do you feel about being asked how you are in the context of recovery and it being public and all that?
I feel wonderful being asked by you. I feel different all the time about
it. Yeah, yeah.
I feel great and safe being asked by you. But when you talk in any interview, or I always feel like you understand things that I need people to understand to be able to talk about it. Mm. I don't know. It's weird, Jeanette, to be 46 and to have somebody be like, you have this thing. I didn't even know that I was anorexic. I thought I was just really strongly disciplined. So I am finding myself doing a lot of the recovery work that I listened to you talking about in your recovery work. Like, I'm fascinated by your story of what happened in your family, but I'm way more fascinated by what you're learning right now and how you're individuating now and freeing yourself from familial shit, because actually that's what we're all doing on different levels. And so I just think the way you talk is so helpful. And I heard you recently talking about hypervigilance.
Yes.
Like, I'm worried about you right now. I'm worried about the pillow behind you. I want to know if everything's okay.
I think one of the things about your book that was really deeply important for me is because you wrote in such a real raw way, it made me understand the process that Glennon is actually going through right now. Talking about safety, like in body, talking about wanting to be invisible, talking about all of the obsessiveness. I didn't understand. I mean, we had a conversation last night because of your book that I didn't really understand how much energy she was spending thinking about her eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And you talk about even little things like speaking in extremes. I heard you talking about how you're trying to use gentler language or something, like not speak in extremes.
I know this to be true of myself. And sometimes when I'm like trying to be softer with myself, I'm like, fuck, like I just want to like give it to myself. But it generally doesn't work when I've done that way for years and years and years. Self-compassion isn't my natural instinct. I think it's getting there more so, but it's just not how I generally communicate with myself.
Yeah.
How about all of you? Do you just go to compassion?
Oh yeah. That's where I've been.
No
whole
way.
No. But even for me, it's speaking in extremes about anything.
Yes.
Like I don't dislike someone. I hate them. I want to stab them. I'm not just,
not literally,
I'm
folks.
Not just like a little bit bored. I'm going to die. I will die if I stay in this place. And so my therapist was like, maybe we just bring it down a little bit. And so I think about what kind of people would speak like that. And I think it might be people who believe that their needs are not going to be met if they just speak normally. Like, who ratchet it up.
That rings true.
Because we feel like in order for anyone to believe that we need anything, it has to be so intense.
That is fascinating.
Wow.
Maybe? I don't know.
It sounds true to me. Yesterday, I lost a newspaper. I'm embarrassed. I saved a newspaper where it was like, I was number one on the list. I saved the newspaper because I was really proud of it. It's interesting. And why am I embarrassed to say that?
Right.
I felt like, ooh, I can't say that. I don't know. You know?
Yes.
But so I saved this newspaper and then it wasn't on the counter where I left it. And I like collapsed onto the kitchen floor, like my head and my hair. And I'm like, like that level of crying. And then I found it where I moved it.
Of course
it was there, but I went to the 10 immediately. I didn't go to a 3. I didn't go to a 4. I went to the 10, collapsed. Like, this is, the world is ending because I can't find this newspaper. How am I ever possibly going to find this newspaper again? So I really relate to that a lot.
The inner voice. And I want to talk about the inner voice for you because you deal with OCD, right? So yeah. One of my favorite stories about you is when you were little and the OCD voice or the intrusive thought started, but you thought it was the Holy Spirit, which P.S. I think is really interesting for people raised in religious traditions. I have a voice that I thought was God forever, that it was not God at all. It was the echoes of people who had purported to speak for God. That's a whole nother thing about religious trauma and realizing that the mean voice in your head isn't God. but my favorite part is when your grandpa said, I think Jeanette might be struggling with OCD, but you thought it was the Holy Spirit. So in order to end the mystery, you just asked the voice, are you OCD or are you the Holy Spirit?
Brilliant.
And the voice said, I'm the Holy Spirit. So that was settled.
Done deal.
As you said.
Done deal.
How Thank is you, that God. Going? What is that like? How do you understand it now? What's that experience like for you?
I definitely understand it to be OCD. I label it that way when it comes up, when I feel it coming up, because it just, labels help me. I know they're not the most helpful for some people, but I really like a label, like a sticker on it, and like to be able to compartmentalize it in my brain as this is that part. But I've noticed it comes up a lot for me when I have a lot of pressure. If I'm doing press, particularly like live press, oh my God, it's like I'll be doing the twirling, I'll be doing the touching the doorknobs, I'll be touching certain parts of my body, ritualistic behavior, I'm rolling up my pant leg, rolling down my pant leg. It just, it gets more triggered around high pressure situations. I've wondered if it's, is it press because it's high pressure or is it press because of what my history is with press? And I think it's probably more so the history, but even like I've been holding on to certain things. I can't like, I had this shampoo bottle that I was using when the book came out and I felt like, oh, well, this is going so well that I can't get rid of the shampoo bottle because then things aren't going to go well anymore. Like if I get rid of this shampoo bottle, it was also a cute shampoo bottle. It had a little elephant on it. So, you know,
I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to know.
There's that.
It's hard to know.
But it's fine now. Like it's fine now. It does have its flare ups. And I try to have a sense of humor about it is I guess the truth of it. I try to be like, okay, there's that thing that's happening again. And I'll be like, is it going to really, it's fine if I don't twirl. And then I'm like, but I got to twirl. Just got to twirl.
It must be interesting to have such an overbearing mom for so long. You didn't even have enough time or space or individuation to have an inner voice. Everything was her voice and what she told you. So do you remember when you started to understand that you had an inside voice that you could start to depend on? When do you remember beginning to individuate? I remember reading the story about how your body rejected having your first kiss on the set. That's
Frozen.
Interesting. Like your body was for the first time was like, no.
I guess I was probably 14 or 15 at that point. I had never kissed anyone, never, you know, I would even try to shut out, you know, romantic thoughts of any kind because I felt like, well, that's a sin. I don't want to be doing that. God wouldn't want that. And then there was a scene written in the show I was on where I had to kiss a boy and I was petrified, like truly petrified about it. I really didn't want to do it. The producer comes over as I'm doing because my whole body kind of, it felt like I was frozen, like I couldn't move, you know, my co-star, who was just lovely and so nice and knew that I was so stressed about it, was like trying to be really kind and like making sure I was comfortable. And I was not, like, I clearly was not. That's not his fault at all. And he would be doing the kiss like a normal person does a kiss. He was like moving his mouth around and, you know, doing things with his face. And I was literally like, my mouth was slung open. My shoulders were stiff. My eyes were wide. The producer comes over and he's like, Jeanette, can you like move your face around a little bit? Like get into the kiss a little bit. And I'm thinking like, okay, yeah, got it. Take direction. If I just think that I'm acting, I can just do it and I can just switch out of myself and be the thing. But I couldn't do it. My body, it was to this point where my body was saying, you know what? No, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be kissing somebody that I don't want to kiss for a scene. I don't care if it's for a scene. I don't care if it's for a TV show. I don't care. Like my body was refusing for one of the first times to do what I was trying to force it to do. And I've always, since the anorexia started, I've always been able to force my body to do what I wanted it to. And then it just started saying, no, that's not going to happen. And my relationship with my body over the past few years has been a lot about letting my body call the shots. And that's been completely new. I'm always trying to like shoehorn in logic or intellectualize my way out of like what my body is telling me. Hey, you know, I really need to rest. This came up over Christmas. It was like, I need to order Hawaiian barbecue every meal, watch Survivor. We're going to plow through 8 seasons in 2 weeks. And that's what it's going to be. And I was like, no, we're going to write. We're going to type. And I was like trying to be at the computer, forcing the words out. And I was like, this is like this passionate. It's not going to work. If I write this way, it's going to be trash. So I might as well just listen to my body. And then my body dictated when I was ready to move on and letting it call the shots is uncomfortable, but I also feel like really important just considering my history and I'm sure anyone who has a similar relationship with their body understands what I'm talking about.
I was really amazed by that part when you thought that your objectives in getting into therapy was to figure out how to forgive your mom. Like that was kind of like, okay, I can do that. It's all good. Moving right along. Speaking of labels, I will slap the label of forgiven. All will be well.
Yeah.
And when you were sitting down with one therapist, she said, what if forgiveness is not the goal? What was the quote? Stop trying to do your mom's work.
That's still you doing your mom's work. And I doubled over and just, I mean, a once in a lifetime kind of, you know, therapeutic breakthrough sob came out of me. And I just realized, yeah, I'd been doing therapy totally to get to this goal that I had in my mind of finding forgiveness for my mom. I was doing therapy, self-work for my mom. I was trying to find a way to make everything okay that she had done. I was trying to find a way to feel the same way that I felt toward her growing up, feel the way that I yearned to feel toward her. And I couldn't. And finally accepting that and having the permission to not have to be like forcing forgiveness was incredible. Cause I think that's the thing. I don't know. My approach to therapy so often in the beginning and still my instinct is to like force my way to the goal. I still want results. I still want there to be an end point. I'm still like, God, I gotta fucking do this for the rest of my life. Like,
so exhausted.
Apparently
all of us do.
Probably.
But I just think that helped me so much. That line, the stop doing your mom's work, because really when we're trying that hard to forgive, what I'm always trying to do is to make it make sense, understand, actually just make it make sense, which is not our job. It doesn't make sense. That's the person's job.
Yeah.
That's what-
Or life's job.
Their therapy.
Like life doesn't make one shred of sense.
Right. But I just don't, I truly, and Sister and Abby know this, like two things I don't understand that I will ask random people, I will ask my waiter, I will ask anyone to try to explain to me, gender and forgiveness. What is forgiveness? Everybody's just saying this word. No one can explain it to me. None of the smartest psychologists in the world know what the fuck it means. And we're all trying for it. Do you have any idea what it is?
Yes. Or you know what gets me when people are like, you don't forgive for them, you forgive for you. I'm like, well, forgiving fucking them is going to make me goddamn angry.
So right. And also the problem for me is not for whom it's for. I'll forgive for my mailman if someone will explain to me what it actually is. Does it mean having good feelings? Does it mean not being angry anymore? Because that's not about to happen. I don't know.
Right. Thank you.
I don't know what it means. Yeah.
That's what we've all been yearning to say. Yeah.
When I was traveling internationally for soccer, I didn't have time to come up with all sorts of travel itineraries when all I could think about were the matches we needed to focus on. But it was important to me that I saw the world while I was abroad. Viator can help with that in a big way. Everything from nature walks to guided history tours or adventure sports, all of it can be booked through Viator. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book over 300,000 travel experiences around the world, no matter who you're with or where you're going. We've used Viator for family trips, and things like real reviews from fellow travelers really helped inform our decisions for which experiences to book. And because plans can easily change for a whole host of reasons, it was nice to know that free cancellation was available. So if you want to explore the globe, or even your neighborhood in a new way, download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experience for you. Do more with Viator. One thing I want to ask about your relationship with your mom, and something that I really related with you on, is this childhood success, being on television, it being kind of your mom's dream, you quasi believing it's your dream, you get good at it, you get famous for it, you're getting all of these positive affirmations for it.
Does this sound familiar to you at all?
It's very confusing.
I want to ask you so many things.
Yeah. Okay. So confusing, right? And then you're kind of like through your teenage years and you're like, well, shit, I can't really do anything else because this is what I've spent all of my life doing. I think this is what I get my self-esteem from. Mm. And I don't know how you'd answer this, and I'm really curious to know, would you change anything?
And last night you were talking to me about what it's like when people say two things to you. One, but you're so good at this. Oh, so yeah. You should want to do it.
Yes.
Because she was so good at it. So of course she has to. Or anybody else would be so glad to have this thing.
Oh, yep.
Like people shouldn't have to do things because they're good at them.
Mm-hmm.
And two, you don't have to do something just because somebody else might like to do that thing.
That's right.
Then they should do that thing.
They should do that thing.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh my God. I'm like really letting that sink in. That's such an important thought. I feel so sure there are so many people doing things because they've been told those exact two things over and over and over again. And it's this guilt complex that just builds and builds and builds and builds and builds. Like, God, I'm ungrateful. God, I'm good at it. Okay, I should do what I'm good at. I'm sure that will sink in for a lot of people. Would I change anything? To be completely honest, I get more self-worth than I would like from success. It's just in my blood. It's in my system. It's in my patterning, my makeup. I've really tried to work on it. And the fact that I have success now makes me say, oh, well, it was all worth it. Mm-hmm. It was all worth it because now look where we are.
Huh.
But I don't know if without the success, I would feel that way. Like, it's just totally honest.
It's a really
comfortable to say.
Really truthful and honest thing. Because I told Glennon, I was like, even though I don't know if it was fully my choice to do what I did, I wouldn't change it because now I have the life that I have. And I actually just am going to amend what I said to Glennon. What you just said is more true.
Yeah.
I'm a success person. I like feeling successful. It feels good in my bones. Is that because of the way that I was raised? Is that because it's instinct, like in my DNA? I don't know, but I love that.
Abby, is there a part of your, I always felt like with before going into auditions, my nervous system was hijacked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd pee 15 times. I'd be like shaky, 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 shaky. And then to have to like overcome that every time to show up and do the thing, my face is shaky. I don't know if you can see this. I feel like it's twitching, thinking of that experience. Yet my life is now at a place where I don't have to overcome that nervous system hijack. And I like sometimes crave the nervous system hijack because I'm like, well, is this it? Like, I don't have to do that like intense volcano happening inside and then calm that and then go and perform and do the thing. Like, if I don't have to do that, I'm just skating by. This isn't like, I need to be struggling. I need to be having that experience. Life, do you feel this at all?
Life can't just be comfortable.
Yeah. My experience is a little different because my personality, I'm the youngest of seven and I loved it when people looked at me and when the pressure was like at the highest, that's when I got the calmest. Which is probably what allowed me to be so capable for the length of time that I played soccer. Yes. But I understand, because I get that nervous hijacking happen when I have to give a huge speech and read in public. I get that. My brain stops working. I sweat. Mm-hmm. I get lost. And no, I don't ever want that.
You say that, I relate to this very much though. And you say that the healthier you got, the less acting felt healthy for you.
Yep.
I, in the early weeks of my recovery, found myself on a stage, looked out and thought, well, this isn't going to fucking work anymore. No. Nope.
Wow.
Nope. Because I think I was in my body for the first time and I was like, oh, wait, this is ridiculous. Why would anyone do this? What is happening? And the only way I could do this, honestly, I'm just going to stand up on stage and be like, I don't fucking know what's going on in my life. I can't act anymore, which feels so healthy. Tell us about that. You had that moment, right?
Yeah. For me, it was that I had always wedged my psychology into like a character's psychology. It's a really weird thing to do, I think, if you're not psychologically developed. I was 11 years old. Before I was on a kid's show, I booked a lot of like procedural dramas and the thing where the girl's like the murderer or she's abused or she's been kidnapped or she's got Stockholm syndrome, like always just the heaviest roles. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, well, probably going to get this one because I can cry on cue and I can be fucking real sad. Like, so great. And then after my mom died, I felt like, well, okay, my mom was my identity and acting was my identity for so long. And neither of these things feel right anymore. It was a point where my body was starting to say, no, no more. I can't go do an audition. I can't accept this. It's hard to say, but there'd be opportunities that, yeah, my agents would be on the other line being like, you'd be crazy to not go. You're going straight to a screen test for this sitcom made by this big sitcom creator and you're not going to do it. And I thought like, I can't pratfall over one more carpet in my life or my soul will be gone out of my body. Mm-hmm. It will be sucked out of my body because it's just, right?
And it's true. Like
you'd be betraying your soul. You'd be betraying your soul to do it again.
Yes. Yeah. And that's another, I guess, extreme way of looking at it. And I'd get mad at myself. Like, why can't I just show up and do a sitcom and be like, hey, I'm being wacky. I couldn't do it. I was suffering. I was in a lot of pain and I couldn't just like show up for the bright lights and do the little head bobble and the catchphrase or whatever. Like there's a certain point when a sitcom catchphrase just feels like hell. I think if you're really in a dark place, and I was, and I needed to take some time for myself. But for me, that meant walking away from acting. And I think it was so I could figure out how I actually thought and felt instead of how would this character feel and think in this situation, constantly putting aside my own emotion. It didn't matter how I was feeling growing up. It was, how does Josie Boyle feel for this scene? Can you imagine what Josie Boyle feels like? It's like, how about can I imagine what I feel like? And I finally felt that I needed to figure that out. And I debated a lot. My grandparents really did not want me to quit acting. It was the, you're so good at it. It was the, how many people would just die to be in your situation. And I eventually quit. And it was not easy because then I had to deal with the self-doubt of quitting and the regret of quitting. And oh, should I have done that? You know, I started trying to write and it's like, the second I tell my agents I just want to quit acting and I want to focus on writing, they're like, see ya. Bye. We don't want to represent you anymore. We don't know if you can do that. We know you can do this, but no. And it was painful. And there were many nights in a fetal position, crying and doubting and thinking, God, did I make the worst mistake of my life? How can something be what I needed to do and also maybe the worst mistake of my life?
How can something be what I needed to do and also be the worst mistake of my life?
Yeah, it was really, really tough. And I doubted myself a lot, but my mental health needed it. Also, I was working on my bulimia at the time and acting was a direct trigger for it. I'll just say it. It was a direct trigger for it. The environments of acting, the constant rejection, the constant need to be better than, and the constant comparison. Every trigger I could possibly have for bulimia was triggered for me by acting. And so I felt like I needed to absolutely shut that door. I couldn't like sometimes do it and maybe occasionally. Yep. And if it's the right role, like, no, there's no right role. The right role is me being me for right now and figuring out bulimia.
I think it's so important to just talk about this idea of quitting. We've talked about this on prior podcasts. It has such a negative tone to it, quitting, but it created space for you to really sit down and write this beautiful book. We have to, as a culture, stop talking about this idea of quitting as bad.
And resilience as good.
Right.
Fuck resilience. I hate resilience.
Thank you.
Yeah, we should all just keep going as much as possible in shitty situations. So like, no.
Yes. Can you say more about resilience? When did I hate that word.
Yeah. I think that resilience, the glorification of resilience has to be something that was made up by people in power that wanted to keep people going in bad systems and call that a badge of honor. Resistance, boycotting, marching, quitting. Those are all things that people who have a big, super strong inner selves that are like, I'm not going to keep doing this unhealthy thing at the expense of my own mental health and my own joy and freedom for you. I don't feel proud of resilience. I feel proud of figuring out what isn't working and then being like, I'm not going to do this, even if everybody else wants that thing. Even if success is on the other side of it, even if it's celebrated. That's why I am so in love with people who walk away from things that everybody else would want just because it doesn't work for them, whether it's like a marriage or a job or a career. That should be celebrated. I will be upset if we don't talk about, I feel strongly about your title of your book. I have retroactive fear that someone would convince you to change it. Like, you didn't. It's for sure the title. But I love titles that are a big idea that people need to talk about more. I have two good friends over the last 2 years who have lost parents, and the relationships were very, very, very fraught. And because of our closeness, those two friends have discussed with me that when their parents died, there was grief and sadness, and there was a freeing that was, they could feel it in their body, that like they had been living two lives at one, and then that person was gone and they felt freer than they'd ever felt before. And nobody is allowed to talk about that. But of course it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think that the title was earned as shit. And probably just the title has freed a lot of people to talk about that part of losing a complicated relationship.
I hope so. I think so. Certainly everyone and their brother tried to get me to change the title.
I bet.
Except for my editor. He was really the one person. My agent sent the book to 7 people and 6 of them passed. And they were all like, some of them, he said, I didn't even read the proposal because you can't do a title like this. It's like, okay, cool, great.
Aren't they regretful?
But I'm so lucky that my editor, actually his mom passed away from cancer as well. And even if he didn't relate to the, you know, particular sentiment of being glad that a parent died in the way that I did, he understood what I meant by it. Mm-hmm, and he really believed that it was a message worth sharing. And he was, I mean, always in my corner at the meetings that I can't imagine how uncomfortable they were when the whole marketing team hears, hey, Simon & Schuster marketing team, we're coming out with a book called I'm Glad My Mom Died. Have a great time figuring this one out.
Like, it's just a delightful romp.
But it's so perfect because it's got this lovely yellow color. And on the bookshelves, we go to bookstores all the time. It's this amazing like juxtaposition between sweet and what?
So good.
It really showed me the power of having one person in your corner who really understands it. I mean, he was the person every draft, every marketing meeting, every cover meeting where he was backing me up and he understood what I was going for and he would challenge me in all the right places and all places that I think made it better. But really the fundamental, the key pieces that I think were like the spirit of it, he got and supported. Mm-hmm. Sean Manning. I shout him out whenever I can. He was just the best.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want. Fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and more. Whatever you're interested in, no matter your climate and space. Fast-growing trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off your first purchase when you use the code HARDTHINGS at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code HARDTHINGS at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code HARDTHINGS. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Before you were talking about the adrenaline high of going into auditions, the relationship with your mom had all of this, the same kind of like intensity and adrenaline where it was like the tension building up, the explosion, the coming back together tenderness. Yes. And you're in a very long-term relationship. And I've heard you talk about how sometimes you're like, and I think this is also so important and liberating to talk about for people. Like, is this too boring? I have some of that too with like used to Tolmet being like sexy and that's where life is in this, you know, spiral of, yes, of emotions. People don't talk about that enough.
Well, and then also like nothing's better than makeup sex. It's like after you have this like, yes, blowout fight and you're like, I'm not talking to you. And it's this just chaos. And I was like, oh, and the passion is crazy. I was hooked into that dynamic in really a lot of my previous relationships. And anyone that was shorter term, I realized I left because it was too functioning. Mm-hmm. I'm ashamed of that, but it felt like there was some part of me, I just wanted to be with an addict. I wanted to feel like I had something to fix so I could avoid my own stuff. I wanted the colorful dynamics, I'll say, to be polite. Mm-hmm. And now I've been in this relationship with Ari for almost 7 years, and we were friends for 2 years beforehand, and it couldn't be healthier or more functioning. And then I find my therapy sessions being like, I'm bored. Mm-hmm. I'm fucking bored. Sometimes there is that part of me that, you know, whether it's the nervous system hijacking, wherever it comes from, my nervous system is just like with the ease and with the health and with the comfort. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't feel challenging enough. Mm-hmm. It just feels like, can it be this simple? Can it be this healthy? And yeah, candidly, I've had many a therapy session about tolerating the boredom of something being really healthy while also really knowing that this is what's best for me and right for me and good for me, and navigating it hasn't been the easiest.
And that makes sense because you said because of the way you grew up, you've always been clear in crisis and anxious and calm. So it would make sense that when you're in the stability of a calm functioning relationship, there is that anxiety where you're like, where's the heat at here?
Yes.
Like, where is it?
Yes. Yes. 100%. It's now more familiar just being that we've been together for so long. I think there's some rewiring happening. I mean, I guess there would have to be at some point. But it definitely has taken a long time, and I still get the urges. I still get the instincts. I know you guys have been talking a bit about sort of internal family systems, and I've been exploring that a bit. And there is that part of me that, like, the image that comes to mind is like, I'm in the middle of a parking lot, like, I don't know, a 7-Eleven parking lot or something. Lord knows why. It's just the image that comes to mind. I'm like flipping everybody off, my tongue sticking out. I've got this like angry expression on my face. I'm like, ah, like just ready to like fuck things up. And that is a part of me. And
Jeanette.
Something that's been working is trying to have a sense of humor about it.
Oh my God. Mine is Brittany when she was bald and had the umbrella and hitting the car. I don't know.
Yep.
That's in me somewhere.
Yep.
When you were talking about the fight and then the makeup sex, that feels very much like bulimia to me. And I've never thought about it until you said this. But that dynamic of like, I'm going to kick my own ass and like eat all the food. Blah, and then I'm going to throw it all up and have this like euphoric like makeup. It's like a makeup thing.
Catharsis.
Yeah. And then in work. So that's like what we did with food. And then in work, it was like this, I'm going to terrorize myself and have the moment beforehand when it's so upsetting, and then it'll be over, and then it'll be euphoric. And then in relationships, and I just wonder if part of our, this next phase, I'm saying us because clearly we're just in this together, is it okay just to be comfortable? Like your work now, like you're writing and you're writing beautifully and you're in charge. You're creating and you're deciding. I said to somebody recently, I'm thinking about moving.
Mm-hmm. You are?
Well, you know, we're always on Zillow and shit.
Oh my God.
And somebody said, oh, you don't like it there. And I was like, no, I love it here. Like, this is the first time I've ever been happy. Mm. So like, certainly I should move. Right. Clearly, it's too nice.
Yeah.
It's like you're creating your own chaos drama to be able to solve it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's exactly it. Wow. Yeah. I feel that so much in my bones. I have a lot more work obligations now. There's a lot more to do. There's a lot more to deal with and to handle. So I'm trying to convince myself, well, that's the chaos. That's what I can, that's what I can fix. That's what I can solve. And that's been to varying degrees effective, depending on the day. And then there's sometimes where there's just still the urge. Do you guys have tools that work a lot of the time for you for dealing with the urges, the tension? So that it's not the creating the chaos to then solve it later. Like, I feel like I did it with bulimia and tolerating those urges and letting and getting to the other side of them and realizing, oh, at some point they'd go down and then I don't have the urge anymore. And that's amazing. And just having enough experience of that under my feet started feeling like power and it started feeling really good. But in other areas, it just wants to come out. And I'd love tips on how to just ride it to the other side.
Mine is art. Like poetry. I write poems that are so fucking weird, Jeanette. I just would be so scared that if anyone would see them. It's like my ragey, dark, canyony self. Not a good person to run my life. Not good in making decisions. But has to live somewhere or it'll come out. So for me, it's like art that no one will ever see.
For me, a lot of the conversations we have has to do with embodiment or lack thereof, right? And so I believe that one of the reasons why I can feel good in laziness and contentment and not needing to create chaos to fix it, I do things for my body that ground me and that bring me closer to the earth, whether it be walks or surfing or doing any kind of like lifting. And now I guess I'm getting into yoga, starting to try to like it. And that always brings me some sense of contentment inside of my body to become an embodied person.
For me, instead of looking at like calm as the absence of excitement, I try to look at it as its own thing. Like, it isn't something that lacks something else. It's a whole separate thing. A thing that has its own beauty and value and isn't defined only by its opposition to this other thing that I very much understand, that it is a gift. And so when something is safe and calm, it's not just the absence of something else. Oof. It's like this thing to really learn to understand and appreciate.
I didn't even realize that I saw calmness that way until you just said that. That's completely how I view it. I view it as the absence of something else, the lack of something else, the lack of what I'm most familiar with. And so it feels, God, that's really good.
Thank you, Jeanette.
We can do hard things, so Pod Squad. Just, I mean, Jeanette, I can't wait to read your new book. Please send it to me as soon as it comes out. Please, please, or beforehand. Just let me know if you ever need anything. I think you're absolutely wonderful. Unique.
Thank you.
We love you, Jeanette.
I love you guys.
We can do hard things, Pod Squad. We will see you back here next time.
Amazing.
Thank you for having me.
If this podcast means something to you, it would mean so much to us if you'd be willing to take 30 seconds to do each or all of these three things. First, can you please follow or subscribe to We Can Do Hard Things? Following the pod helps you because you'll never miss an episode, and it helps us because you'll never miss an episode. To do this, just go to the We Can Do Hard Things show page on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and then just tap the plus sign in the upper right-hand corner or click on follow. This is the most important thing for the pod. While you're there, if you'd be willing to give us a 5-star rating and review and share an episode you loved with a friend, we would be so grateful. We appreciate you very much. We Can Do Hard Things is produced in partnership with Cadence 13 Studios. I give you Tish Melton and Brandi Carlile.
I walked through fire, I came out the other side. I chased desire, I made sure I got what's mine. I continue to believe that I'm the one for me, and because I'm mine, I walk the line, 'cause we're adventurers and heartbreaks on map, a final destination. Stopped asking directions to places they've never been. And to be loved, we need to be known. We'll finally find our way back home. And through the joy and pain that our lives bring, we can do hard. To be loved, we need to be known.
I am an outdoors person. I'm a big fan of places that are steeped in culture, history, and arts. And most importantly, I'm a former resident of the great state of Oregon, which is why it's great to partner with Travel Oregon. And when you find a guide through Travel Oregon, you'll be able to leave the planning to the local guides and experts. And this is a game changer. When we're traveling with my family, safety is always something that's on our minds. It's probably not one of the main things you think about when booking a trip, though. That's just one benefit of going with a guide in Oregon. They'll know where to bring you. They're passionate about showing people around, and they know that even adventure seekers like myself want to know that they're in good hands. Plus, you'll be supporting small businesses while having the time of your life. From biking to museums to culinary delights, best food ever, there's so much to experience. Learn more at traveloregon.com.